Good evening. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for Thursday, August 10, 2017. Starting with Goldman Sachs, the global investment banking securities and investment managing firm, a meeting today at their corporate headquarters to secure financing for oil and gas projects like the Dakota Access Pipeline, Pilgrim, Keystone XL, and other sands pipelines brought out protesters, Native leaders, New York Communities for Change, and Food and Water Watch. Rick Chiboya from New York City is with the American Indian Community House. He's in front of Goldman Sachs with other protesters to let them know that they know what's going on inside the building.
They're meeting with oil financiers, people who finance pipelines all over. Most importantly to me, financing oil pipelines that go through native land, indigenous land, sovereign land, treaty-based land. They shouldn't be there. They are. But it's not just against us, it's against all humanity. They're polluting the world. They're affecting climate change. And they think they can go up to their boardrooms and make these decisions and nobody knows about it, but we know about it. Wherever they are, we'll be there. Wherever they're building, we're gonna be there. Wherever they're meeting, we're gonna be there. So it doesn't matter what they think they can do without us knowing about it, we're gonna know about it. We're gonna be here with people, standing up, making noise, resisting, you know, stopping them however we can.
Former Goldman Sachs executives line Donald Trump's cabinet. There's Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, his deputy, James Donovan, White House strategist Steve Bannon. There's Gary Cohn, director of the White House National Economic Council, and Dina Powell, White House senior counselor for economic initiatives, all former Goldman executives.
Trump administration is full of Goldman Sachs people. And that's where you make the connection between why did Donald Trump start the pipeline at Standing Rock again the day after he was elected? Because he's got all these people who finance a pipeline as part of his inner circle. He's got all kinds of money. All his friends have all kinds of money in these pipelines. Pipelines are the worst idea. There's all kinds of other renewable energies that are better, but they have tons, millions, billions of dollars tied up in this. And so they're going to make sure that all their friends and themselves are going to profit. This swamp is more full than ever. There's all these greedy MFs in there as more than ever. You know, the wealthiest, most powerful people are all within Trump administration and all his inner circle. So the swamp is dirtier than ever.
We stand with Standing Rock, city by city, block by block. We stand with Standing Rock, city by city, block by block.
Alex Beechin is the Northeast Regional Director at Food and Water Watch. He says his organization is proud to stand with New York Communities for Change and indigenous leaders to stand up and protest the Goldman Sachs Pipeline Conference.
This is really the intersection of the finance industry and the fossil fuel industry. And so we're here urging Goldman Sachs to stop funding dirty pipelines that are ruining native lands, poisoning the air, and warming the climate. Today, hundreds gathered to rally against it, and also we had several brave folks who were able to block the entrance of Goldman Sachs, so their headquarters in New York City, 200 West Street. And so you had several folks block the entrance for, I don't know, half an hour or so before the police finally arrested them. I believe there are four folks who were arrested. I'm not totally positive about that, but I think there are at least four. And I think these folks came with the intention of getting arrested to show solidarity with folks in Standing Rock, with folks who are fighting fracked gas pipelines, folks who are fighting the fossil fuel industry all across the country. So, you know, they came expecting this to happen. But I think it shows just how stiff the resistance is. And, you know, we're going to keep building and building until we finally shut it all down.
My name is Cheryl Dupree. I'm a full-blooded Sioux from the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation. I live and retired here in New York City. I've been here over 20 years now. And my father is from the Standing Rock Reservation, and my mother is from the Cheyenne River. And the flag that I'm holding is my reservation. That's who I represent. I don't speak on their behalf, and I don't speak on the behalf of DAPL. But I'm a citizen of this reservation, and so I want to support the issues that concern our reservations. And that's the DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline.
White House School holds Namas Baus, Inches Guis Guillaume Tolks. What is in your heart today? My name is Guillaume Tolks, otherwise Anastasia. I'm from the Colville Confederated Tribes, the Eniat Band. So there's nothing I can say that isn't easily accessible to all of you online through other Indigenous people. But I am just another person, another woman, another Native woman, standing here today as proof that this is hurting us right now. It's not some idea of the future that it will potentially hurt us. We are being hurt right now. This is happening right now. People want to debate and they want to think and they want to discuss what we should do with our environment, what we should do with our future, but this isn't something we can discuss. This is what's happening right now. There are pipelines underneath us right now. There are pipelines being built right now. The nature is being harmed by pipelines right now. This is something that we are living. This isn't an idea to discuss. This is happening now, and this needs to be a fight that's happening right now. And I'm here as proof that Native people will always be standing here, whether it is facing colonization through war or facing colonization through pipelines. Lim Lim, thank you.
No tar sands, no destruction of Native lands.
No pipelines, no tar sands, no destruction of Native lands.
Protesters want Goldman Sachs to stop financing oil, gas, coal, and pipelines, and they are exposing the bank's control over Donald Trump and the federal government. As well, activists are urging New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to reject fracking infrastructure projects like the Pilgrim pipelines. They would carry fracked, volatile, dirty Bakken shale oil and flammable refined products between Albany and Linden, New Jersey. Activists say this poses unnecessary and unacceptable risks to our waterways, to our climate, and to the health, safety, and welfare of communities along the pipeline path. This includes people who are simply traveling on the New York State Thruway. And you're listening to the news on listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio. This is WBAI New York. This afternoon, Donald Trump continued warmongering rhetoric against North Korea. He spoke to reporters outside his golf resort in New Jersey when asked about his comment yesterday when he said North Korea better not make any more threats against the U.S. or they will be met with fire and fury like they have never seen. He was asked if the warning was too tough.
Maybe it wasn't tough enough. They've been doing this to our country for a long time, for many years. And it's about time that somebody stuck up for the people of this country and for the people of other countries. So if anything, maybe that statement wasn't tough enough. And we're backed by 100% by our military. We're backed by everybody. And we're backed by many other leaders. And I noticed that many senators and others today came out very much in favor of what I said. But if anything, that statement may not be tough enough.
What would be tougher than fire and fury?
Well, you'll see. You'll see.
Trump says he'll always consider negotiations, but then he says this.
But they've been negotiating now for 25 years. Look at Clinton. He folded on the negotiations. He was weak and ineffective. You look what happened with Bush. You look what happened with Obama. Obama, he didn't even want to talk about it. But I talk. It's about time. Somebody has to do it.
And while there are many in the U.S. who think Trump is a loose cannon, today, despite the warmongering, Trump says the people of this country shouldn't be nervous about tensions with North Korea. Then he says the U.N. sanctions voted on this weekend unanimously against North Korea won't be effective, and he calls on China to do much more. And then in true Trump style, he ratchets up the warning against North Korea.
The people of this country should be very comfortable. And I will tell you this, if North Korea does anything in terms of even thinking about attack of anybody that we love or we represent or our allies or us, they can be very, very nervous. I'll tell you what, and they should be very nervous because things will happen to them like they never thought possible, okay? He's been pushing the world around for a long time. And I have great respect for what China and what Russia did and those 15, we got a 15 to nothing vote. I have great respect for China and Russia, what they did on sanctions. I believe that will have an effect. I don't think it will have the kind of effect, even though we were the ones that got it. And Nikki Haley did a great job. We all did a great job. But I have great respect for what they did. I have great respect for the 15 to nothing. But probably it will not be as effective as a lot of people think it can be, unfortunately.
Can China do more?
I think China can do a lot more, yes. China can, and I think China will do a lot more. Look, we have trade with China. We lose hundreds of billions of dollars a year on trade with China. They know how I feel. It's not going to continue like that. But if China helps us, I feel a lot differently toward trade. A lot differently toward trade. So we will do, I think, the people of our country are safe, our allies are safe, and I will tell you this, North Korea better get their act together or they're going to be in trouble like few nations ever have been in trouble in this world. Okay?
Donald Trump this afternoon outside his golf resort in New Jersey. In other news, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union of Maine, has sued the governor of Maine, Paula Page, over allegations he misused his Facebook page. It follows similar complaints against Donald Trump, as well as Republican governors of Kentucky, Maryland, and Utah. WBAI's Rebecca Miles has more.
The American Civil Liberties Union of Maine filed their lawsuit in federal district court in Portland after accusing the governor of censoring his official Maine Facebook page. The lawsuit involves two women the ACLU said had their critical comments deleted on his page, and then their pages were blocked from viewing his page. The ACLU of Maine says these actions are a violation of the women's First Amendment rights, freedom of speech. The governor has not commented yet on the lawsuit, but in the past he said his page is run by his advisers and not himself. The ACLU argues the page is used by the governor in his official capacity because it's used to share political news and statements, and it's verified and was previously linked to the governor's Maine.gov page. Ahead of the lawsuit, the ACLU wrote to the governor asking him to stop what they called illegal censoring of his page. This is the latest in an emerging debate about whether elected officials violate people's free speech rights by blocking them on social media, as groups warn politicians to stop the practice. Lawsuits have also been filed by the ACLU against Republican governors in Maryland and Kentucky, and a warning letter sent to Utah's congressional delegation. The Knight First Institute at Columbia University has also filed a complaint against President Donald Trump for deleting people or blocking people from viewing his Twitter account. Politicians at all levels are increasingly embracing social media to discuss government business, sometimes at the expense of traditional town halls or in-person meetings. Most officials say they're policing social media to get rid of people who post abusive messages. For WBAI in New York City, I'm Rebecca Miles.
In other news, thousands of migrants are fleeing the United States for Canada via a remote back road in upstate New York. The Canadians arrest the migrants as soon as they step across the border, but the migrants prefer to take a chance by seeking asylum in Canada rather than risk being deported from the U.S. Canadian police have set up a reception center on their side of the border. It includes tents where migrants are processed before they are turned over to the government agency that handles their application for refuge. Officials estimate 400 people crossed the border at the site last Sunday alone. Canada said it plans to house some migrants in Montreal's Olympic Stadium. It could hold thousands, but currently the stadium only holds 450 people. And you're listening to the news on listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio. This is WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. Dwayne Jun, shot dead on July 31st by police officer Miguel Gonzalez, calls into question how police are responding to requests for help for New Yorkers. The 27-year-old officer of the 67th Precinct fired five shots at the 32-year-old inside Jun's apartment where he lived with his parents. Jun's mom says her son suffered from being bipolar. One cop fired a stun gun. The police say Jun kept advancing and lunged at officers with a knife when he was shot dead by Gonzalez. That officer was involved in another shooting of a man with mental health difficulties, 23-year-old Devont Presley in Canarsie, who, like John, was diagnosed with bipolar disease. Acting Brooklyn District Attorney Gonzalez says his office is doing a full investigation into the shooting. Today at a news conference outside the district attorney's office after a meeting, June's family lawyer Scott Renicki says the case calls into question so many factors surrounding the shooting.
It clearly shines a light on a number of issues. One of the issues here deals with the training of police officers in dealing with emotionally disturbed individuals. What's important to notice in this case is the fact that the police officer who did in fact fire his weapon and was the only police officer that fired his weapon on that day previously had fired his weapon in a situation involving another emotionally disturbed person. It is incumbent upon the police department to retrain these officers in dealing with emotionally disturbed individuals so that these deaths stop. Furthermore, it once again calls to light the fact that it is necessary to have all police officers wearing body cameras. There is a question whether or not Mr. June did in fact have a knife, as the police officers are alleging, and had these police officers had a body camera and had that camera been turned on, we'd have some immediate answers.
Attorney Sanford Rubenstein adds there will also be an investigation into whether there was a cover-up in this case. Brooklyn Councilmember Jamani Williams stands with the family of Dwayne Jun.
I'm here to support this family, who are constituents of mine. I wish I did not have to be here. And unfortunately, this is, I believe, the third high-profile case I've had to deal with in my district, in this precinct, of people being shot, some clearly unarmed. And some disputes of whether they have been armed or not. One, this is the reason we need to unfold the body cams at a much quicker pace than what's happening, so that when there is a dispute like this, we can all look at the same thing. It's another issue of accountability, because obviously Eric Garner was all on camera. We didn't really get accountability there, but at least we have the ability to all look at the same thing. And that is critically important. In addition to that, we are still asking for an independent investigation through the AG's office. I too want to thank the DA for the time that he took in meeting with this family and assuring that the investigation will go forward. But we believe, I believe, that it is best for an independent investigation to occur because of the natural nature of the relationship between the DA and the police department. What I'm calling for is the governor to even though the executive order states one thing, we need to include emotionally disturbed persons in that order. And in addition to that, we need to clarify that when there's a dispute whether the person is armed, we don't automatically assume one way or the other. So we believe when there's an EDP or there is a dispute of whether someone was armed or not, the attorney general should take that case, take it away from the DA, and that is another ask that we have. And the last one is one that I'm continuing to push forward, is a task force needs to be immediately put into place. I'm not happy at all with the mayor's response to that request. I think it was more of a flippant request. And to say that we're going to continue doing what we are doing is not an answer that this city deserves. It's not an answer that this family deserves. It is clear to me as of right now, the city does not have a handle on how to handle emotionally disturbed persons. I cannot, in any good conscience, tell anyone in this city, if they have an emotionally disturbed person, to call 911. I want to change that. In order to change that, we have to agree that that's where we are. We have to look at what the protocol is and figure out how we're going to change it. The Inspector General put a report out a few months ago. I don't even think there was an appropriate response to that. So whatever is happening now must change. We must figure out what the protocol is. There is not even a clear definition of what that is. It's not in the patrol guide. We do believe there's some training happening. We're happy for that. People who were trained were allegedly at the apartment, but the officer who shot and killed Mr. June did not have that training, even though he shot an EDP person last year. Where in the protocol does it say that you would at least not train an officer who was involved previously? Are the 911 operators being trained? What is the exact coordination that's going on with police officers who are trained and other mental health professionals? When does the ESU come in? There's a lot of questions that remains unanswered. This family behind me deserves those answers. The mayor has yet to give those answers. neither has the commissioner, and we believe as a city we deserve those answers. So I hope that the mayor will change his mind on the request that I made. We're going to be putting that in writing, myself and some of my colleagues, demanding that this task force be put in place immediately. We would like a 60-day review of what this protocol is, a response to the Inspector General, and what we're going to do to change it so that we can feel more comfortable telling the city of New York, when you have an emotionally disturbed person, you do not have to be afraid that your loved one would die.
Williams is interested in two main questions. Was protocol followed, and is the current protocol appropriate?
And I think from all of the deaths that we've seen, the answer to that second one is no. And we have to get to a point where it is, which is why my call for a task force should be immediate, which is why I'm disturbed that the mayor currently was so dismissive of it.
The NYPD responds to about 150,000 calls each year for what the agency calls emotionally disturbed people. Police reform advocate and New York City mayoral candidate Bob Ganji says police should not be first responders in psychiatric cases.
It's another terrible incident, another awful result, an unnecessary fatality at the hands of an NYPD officer. Our view is, and we've presented this very strongly when I was director of the Police Reform Organizing Project, and it is now a central part of our mayoral campaign. The police should not be the first responders in emergencies involving individual New Yorkers in psychiatric crisis. What we've proposed is that the 911 dispatcher has at his or her disposal a list of all mental health organizations and social service organizations broken down by community, so that when a call comes in that a person is in psychiatric crisis, let's say in the Hunts Point section of the Bronx, the dispatcher could look up what mental health organizations are in that community, and then the dispatcher would not send a police officer, which is the practice now. The dispatcher would send the mental health professional. And it would be the mental health professional's responsibility for taking steps to resolve the situation in a way that does no harm to the individual in psychiatric crisis or to anyone close to that individual. If the police are present, it would be at the request of the mental health professional. And if there is a decision that physical restraint is needed in dealing with the mentally ill person, that decision will be made by a mental health professional, not the police officers. This approach would be more benign, more effective. We think most police officers would welcome this approach. We think most police officers are not comfortable in this kind of situation, and it would save lives, not end them.
Like Williams, Ganji points to similar incidents involving police responding to 911 calls of emotionally distraught New Yorkers.
The one that's received the most attention and the most publicity was the shooting death of Deborah Danner in the Bronx, a woman who was clearly in psychiatric distress. Police show up. One of the officers goes into her apartment, claims she came at him with a baseball bat, and shot and killed her. These incidents are one or two or three in a long line of these kind of incidents that have taken place in New York City, where police show up and their response to the person in psychiatric crisis results in serious physical harm being done to that person or results in a fatality. And the most effective way to stop the recurrence of these events is to put the responsibility for resolving these situations in the hands of mental health professionals. That's what we urge city policymakers to do now, and that's what we pledge to do if I am elected mayor.
Police reform activist and New York City mayoral candidate Bob Ganji.
Right now we are in pain because this happened like a bolt of lightning. And
Vibert Jun is Dwayne Jun's dad.
We are suffering right now emotionally, but we are people who believe in God, and we know that God is going to help us, and we know we're going to help and so on from the various quarters. And we know the truth would be established, and we want that the process be a process which would help not only my family, but other families who are going through this kind of pain.
A news conference today in Brooklyn on the investigation into the death of Dwayne Jun at the hands of police officer Miguel Gonzalez after a 911 call for help. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Thursday, August 10th, 2017. The news was produced with Akeem Killick, Rebecca Miles, Richard Barr, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.